Good morning, everybody. I would like to call the CAC meeting to order. First of all, do we have somebody who would like to move the minutes, the approval of the...
So moved.
Madam Chair.
What?
Thank you, Representative David. Those minutes have been approved.
Oh,
how's that?
All those in favor
say aye.
Aye.
The minutes are approved. Welcome, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm happy on behalf of the Department of Revenue today to bring forward their policy bill. And if I may, Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 885 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Okay.
And then also, Madam Chair, if I might, there's two amendments to get the bill in the order we'd like it, or that the department would like it. And first, if I may move the A1 amendment,
okay.
Should be in everyone's packet.
Do you members have that amendment?
Yep.
All those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes.
Okay, and thank you, Madam Chair. There's one more amendment to get the bill in the order the department wants it, which is the A09, if I may move the A09-0023 amendment. Oh, excuse me, Madam Chair. I've just been told that the A1 took care of the 23, so I'd like to withdraw that motion.
Okay.
If I may. Thank you.
Representative David.
And if it's all right with you, Madam Chair, then I think what this committee has normally done is heard the department's request for, generally they're not controversial technical changes in the policy bill. It seems every year that we always find some, in fact, that we think as a committee are controversial, and we take them out or discuss them later, and then usually put this bill into the omnibus tax bill. So I'm sure there will be some issues that are raised and that members may want to pull out and to say so we can kind of have those red flags for us. But if it's all right with you, Madam Chair, Ms. Cadoon is going to begin the walkthrough of the bill, and I think she's got a number of people from the Department of Revenue with her to explain the bill to us.
Great. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Cadoon. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Revenue. I want to thank you for hearing the Department of Revenue's technical and policy bill today. The bill contains basically non-budget recommendations that were brought forth from the department. I'll make one exception to that non-budget, which is in Article 1, Section 5, dealing with withholding. We are working on a fiscal note for that provision, so that will have a small dollar revenue raiser attached to it. So we'll get you that information when that's finalized. The bill, as I mentioned, is technical cleanup language as well as some policy recommendations. We tried to really focus on areas that have been identified to really achieve kind of greater compliance with our tax laws, to reduce the complexity and administrative burden both for the department and for taxpayers. What we'd like to do today is we're going to be walking through the bill in the order of the articles, except my understanding is we will not hear Article 5 that deals with the conditional use deed provision. That provision, and my hope is, will be heard in hopefully the property tax division if there's time in that committee. That item does take it's a little more complex to explain, so it would take, I think, a more time than you probably have in this committee today. How I'd like to proceed is we have the legal staff in the department that are expert areas in each of these individual tax types, and so they will come forward and explain each provision. I might recommend, while those attorneys are up here, it might be good to ask questions as you're moving along so that they'll be at the table to address it. With that, Madam Chair, if I could bring up at this point Mark Peterson and Steve Schenkel that will go through Article 1 of the bill. Okay. Madam Chair, I think in your packet it might be best to have the Department of Revenue summary in front of you. It's probably the easiest way to go through the bill at this point. Okay. Thank
My
you.
Name is Steve Schenkel, and I'm only here for Article 1, Section 1. That is a permissive amendment to MnSTAT Section 289.08, Subdivision 3. It's an administrative provision. It applies to large groups of large corporations, unitary businesses. It permits a corporation that's a member of a unitary business to file the combined income report on behalf of the unitary group of businesses, even though they don't have nexus with this state. It's basically creates the legal relationship between the filer and the and the state of Minnesota to permit that corporate filing.
Madam Chair, my name is Mark Peterson. I'm also with the Department of Revenue. I'll do the rest of Article 1. Sections 2 and 3 create a new information reporting requirement for qualified intermediaries to report information to the commissioner concerning like-kind exchanges. The reports will be 30 days after demand by the commissioner. What we're getting at here is Section 1031 of the Internal Revenue Code provides that there's no immediate gain on certain exchanges of property held for productive use in a trade or business or for investment. The rules are very technical, and the result of not doing it right can be very bad for the taxpayer in that they end up having to pay taxes immediately and lose their ability to defer the income into future years. The Internal Revenue Code recognizes the use of a middleman to help facilitate these tax-free trades and use it as qualified intermediaries. So there's no particular requirement to become a qualified intermediary. There's no licensing. They come in all sorts of levels of competence. Generally, though, what we found is on audit, we found that if there's problems on one done by a particular qualified intermediary, it's quite likely that there's going to be problems on others. It's difficult to audit this, and we're hoping to be able to use this as a vehicle for being able to identify problem areas. It's similar to other information reports that we get, such as the 1099s for interest reporting, in that we have the authority to get it, but the taxpayer, the qualified intermediary, would not be required to submit it unless the Commissioner of Revenue demanded of them. Section,
Madam Chair.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you just said, sir, that if you have a qualified intermediary that has no requirements, how qualified must they be?
Mr. Peterson?
Madam Chair, Representative Davis. Well, there's no licensing, and a lot of them are accountants. Presumably, they should be aware of the law. And I mean, they're just called qualified intermediaries. That's just the title given. There technically aren't any real qualifications that they need, not legally anyway.
Makes me feel better.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Polk.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I guess whenever I see provisions like this, I just take a little pause that we're giving the commissioner the authority to, by notice and demand, require somebody to file another return. How common is this throughout Minnesota tax law, and how do these have these qualified intermediaries, regardless of their level of competence or who they might be, have they weighed in on this provision at all? I guess what I'm getting at is this another opportunity for the department to go and do a whole bunch of audits that it right now can't do? And I don't want to see the department, not that you do this, but I don't want to see the department picking on good people trying to find nickels and dimes underneath the couch cushions.
Representative Colt. Well, I think we plan on using it, obviously, or we wouldn't be coming forward with it. I don't know if there's a qualified intermediary group that's weighed in. We want to try to tailor it, though. That's why we're not suggesting at all that this become some sort of mandatory return that all qualified intermediaries do. So, you know, I think our expectation is that we would only use it if we thought that there was going to be valid audit leads off this.
Representative, quickly, do you know, Mr. Peters, is there some type of revenue provision tied to this policy provision? In other words, is the department estimating that it will collect X millions of dollars as a result of having this new authority?
Mr. Peterson?
I don't think we've done that, no.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Section 4, state tax return, just granting an automatic extension for taxpayers to get a six-month extension to file an estate tax return. Under current law, if they have a federal extension, they automatically have a six-month state extension. If they request an extension, a separate state extension, they automatically get a state extension. We wanted to just give them the six-month extension without them having to request it. It's consistent with what already happens for corporate taxes and for withholding taxes.
Section 5. Section 5, under current law, it's very clear that taxpayers are required to report to the Department of Revenue what when there's been a change in their federal withholding tax return. Current law isn't especially clear on what exactly they have to report, and what this is doing is making it clear that when the IRS changes the wages reported federally, that is what triggers the amended return at the state level. Section 6 changes the consequences for failing to withhold wages when an employer fails to withhold wages, or when an independent or someone in the construction trade fails to withhold from the pay of an independent contractor. Under current law, what happens is the Department of Revenue determines if a person is required to withhold. For the employer-employee, this often requires us to make a determination on whether there's been a misclassification. If yes, then we then say you're supposed to do withholding, do it at single and zero exemptions, because that typically hasn't been an exemption certificate. The law also says that they're subject to penalties and interest, so if they've not filed a return, not paid the tax, they could be subject to a penalty of up to 20%. There could be other penalties that apply, and also interest would be due. If that was all there was to this, we probably wouldn't be coming forward with this proposal, but then the next step is that employers are allowed a credit for taxes paid by the employees. Now that, so if the employees have filed their returns, the employer gets off the hook for having to do the withholding. However, that doesn't reduce the applicable penalties and interest that will be assessed against the employer. So this credit means that some audits, after we do a full audit of misclassification, result in no tax, even though the employer clearly failed to meet a withholding obligation. Some of the employers end up with no penalties. So those penalties that I said for a late file and late pay don't apply if the employer actually had some employees, because oftentimes these employers have some employees that they acknowledge as employees, and then they have others that they're misclassifying. If they have reported properly on some of the employees, they have filed the return on time, and so they're not going to end up being subject to those penalties for late filing and late pay, which means that they get virtually no consequence for not doing the withholding. Some employers like to drag out the process as long as possible because they're trying to get the employees to file their returns, because that ends up reducing their liability, which allows the employers then to find out the filing status and the filing records of their workers. Additionally, this provision is going to be very, very difficult to administer for this new withholding on independent contractors, because really in order for us to be able to determine if that income was properly reported and they paid the tax, it's going to essentially require us to do a full audit of each one of the independent contractors. Technically, we'd have to do that with the employees, but employees usually are working only for one, typically we saw that employees are only working for one employer during the year, so it's pretty easy to tell. But for an independent contractor, if they're truly an independent contractor, they're oftentimes going to have all sorts of different sources from all sorts of different payers. It's going to be hard for us to determine if they actually have reported all the income. So what we're doing is proposing replacing that. Under this proposal, we would no longer be able to assess tax against an employer who failed to withhold any tax from the pay of a particular employee. It also would also apply to the person in the construction trades who failed to withhold any pay from a particular independent contractor.
Excuse me, Mr. Peterson. I'm sorry to interrupt you. We have a couple questions, so interrupt you at this point, if that's okay. Representative Solberg?
Madam Chair, thank you, Mr. Peterson. Within the section, I'm a little confused. There already is a penalty available. Are we then removing that penalty and and putting a different penalty in, particularly I think in Section B, there was, it was a little bit unclear with your testimony that if you're removing the penalty or something, I don't see any removing of things. And then a second question afterwards, if you would, please.
Mr. Peterson?
Madam Chair, Representative Goldberg. Well, the penalties that exist in current law are based on amounts of unpaid tax. So by saying that we can't assess tax, there's not going to be any unpaid tax. So this is going to replace the assessment of tax that we make under current law. It's going to replace the penalties that we assess under current law, and it's also going to replace the interest that would be due under current law.
Representative Solberg?
So this goes directly to the employer and not the employee. Let me help understanding. If the employer fails to withhold tax, but the employee pays the tax, maybe late because they didn't make quarterly payments or something like that, and so there's penalties and interest on that result. You're going back after the employer because the employer didn't have any penalty because they failed to do that, to withhold the tax. Is that correct?
Mr. Peterson?
There are penalties in law already for these things, and that's just a little confusing. It looks like it's an additional penalty.
Well, it's a new penalty that is going to apply against the employers, but the other penalties just are not going to apply anymore. Under current law, those penalties sometimes apply to employers, and sometimes they don't, depending on whether they have filed returns for other workers. There's a question of ununiform treatment there. And we think this is going to streamline the process and make it easier for everyone to understand.
Well, I'm sure.
I'm saying that I can't explain it to you.
Then the Section D is not subject to an abatement. That's a little bit strange. That usually, if there's you appeal a decision and the state loses, there's an abatement. And why would we not have some kind of a ability to have an abatement anyway?
Sure, Madam Chair. Well, technically, an abatement is generally something that the commissioner can grant for reasonable cause, and we didn't really want this to be an abatement that was a penalty that could be abated for reasonable cause, because we believe that virtually everybody is going to come in with some reason or some, either a reasonable cause or good faith. So they're all going to come in and say, I didn't know, and they're going to base it on this and, whatever arguments they can make. However, this can clearly be appealed. So if we made a classification determination that this is an employee, and they say, no, it's not, this is an independent contractor, we're not required to withhold, they can appeal that determination. And that's what the part of the sentence after, denying 525, is assessed under 270C33 sub 4, paragraph A, plus 5. That'll allow them to appeal the determination.
Then, to appeal to who?
Well,
Peterson?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, the Commissioner of Revenue, and then to the tax court if they'd
like. But isn't the first one that determines whether there's an abatement the Commissioner of Revenue as well?
Mr.
He says no. He or she says no. Well, I can appeal to them again. I mean, Commissioner makes a lot of money, and some of that should be able to have some kind of standards to say yes or no, and not just arbitrarily with friends or no friends. I mean, it's just so strange to see no abatement ever being available. I just raise that as a flag.
Ms. Kadun, if you want to Madam Chair, just as Mark Peterson mentioned as well, they can appeal directly to tax court as well. They don't have to go through the department. They have the option of either appealing to the department, and then if they don't like that outcome at that point, they can appeal to the tax court, or they can appeal directly to the tax court.
But then, as I read this, maybe I don't read it, they can appeal to the commissioner, but the commissioner doesn't have a choice. He cannot give an abatement.
Madam Chair, you can't grant an abatement. You can't grant an abatement, but if the penalty was wrongfully imposed in the first place, the commissioner can and will cancel the penalty. From the technical, it's a difference between abatement for cause and the penalty not being imposable. It'd be like a fraud penalty. Not that it's a fraud penalty, but a fraud penalty can't be abated for reasonable cause. You never have a reasonable reason to commit fraud. But the taxpayer could appeal it and say, the actions that I did do not rise to the level of fraud. And if that was the case, then that penalty would go away. It would not be, it would be canceled. So we're clearly allowing the taxpayers to appeal their this determination. We're not just saying that, oh, the commissioner says you owe, so therefore you owe. It's clearly subject to a review.
Follow-up, Representative Colbert?
No.
Okay. I have two more people on the list, and I'll move on. Representative Reinert?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Peterson, I guess my question on this is, I know this is an ongoing headache in the construction industry, and you know, in your testimony, what I'm hearing you saying is that the department thinks this is a better approach to trying to enforce these withholdings. My question is, how does the industry feel? I mean, was this change arrived at in conversation with the building trades or with the builders associations? I mean, do they feel that this will work better and be easier to enforce? Because I know a lot of people are out there trying to do it right, and more often than not, they screw it up. So.
Ms. Kadun?
Madam Chair, Representative. For this provision, we have been contacted by the business community and the Builders Association, and they've mentioned they do have some concerns with the language. We have said that we will sit down with them and discuss their concerns and hopefully come to some sort of agreement so everybody can be comfortable with it. So at this point, there's certainly not consensus on this item. So this is an item that simply has a little more controversy to it, as well as I mentioned that this is one that we've been requested to do a fiscal note on, and we're currently doing that, so there'll be some revenue increase that will be put on this provision as well.
And
Representative Brandon?
Ms. Kadun, how about the building trades?
I have not been contacted by them. If they have issues with them, we'll certainly sit down and discuss those.
Right. Thank you.
Representative Broad? Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm trying to connect this to the many efforts that the department has made related to independent contractors over the past few years, which have not really gone very far. So how does this differ?
Madam Chair, members, there's a new provision that was recently enacted that just took effect January of this year for the withholding requirement for the construction industry, if that's what you're referring to. So as I mentioned, that just became effective of January of this year. I'm not sure we've really heard results at this point of how much is currently being withheld. As you know, the construction industry obviously is in a slowdown at this point, so the numbers are maybe less than expected, as well as I think there's been some discussion that maybe some of these individuals, instead of having to do the withholding, are becoming LLCs, which is certainly their prerogative under current law.
Madam Chair, and Mr. Peterson, how something that you said sparked a little question with me in regards to the audit. You said it would independent contractors would then undergo a full audit. Did I hear you incorrectly? It sounded like it would be an assumption that independent contractors were misclassified, and I'm trying to understand how that audit provision works.
Representative Broad, that was in the context of the new withholding in the construction industry for the independent contractors. So that if we determined that there should have been withholding on the pay of the independent contractor, under current law, the person who is supposed to do the withholding is allowed a credit for the taxes paid by that independent contractor when they did their return. So in order for us to be able to determine if that independent contractor
filed a return and paid the tax on that income, we have to do something close to a full audit of that independent contractor to determine if they reported all of that income that was paid by that particular contractor. That's what I meant on that, in order to be able to administer that credit.
Madam Chair and Mr. Peterson and Ms. Kadoon, I look forward to additional conversation on this piece. I think that this is confusing, and if it's intended to streamline, I hope that I can understand it better along the way. Representative Zemmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I have some of the same concerns. One question I had, I was trying to figure this out, fails to withhold tax from wages. Is that, how do we define failure to withhold? Does that mean withhold at all, or withhold the proper amount?
None.
Gets into the W-3 None. And what they've submitted and all that sort of thing. So if I'm an employer and if I withhold an amount that's deemed to be inappropriate later on, did I not withhold? Is that the definition? Or did I not withhold?
Madam Chair, our intent is that it would be only this provision would only apply if you failed to withhold it all for a particular employee.
Okay. Representative Broad, before I call on you, I'm going to ask Mr. Michael if he'd like to comment on this section. Please.
Madam Chair, no, I guess I don't really have any comments. But, I mean, I think part of this is what may be confusing members about this is that it's in part related to this provision that was just enacted last year that relates to independent contractors, but the breadth of this is broader in that it applies to all withholding, which Mr. Peterson was explaining, the situation where employers who fail to withhold may in fact not be subject to penalty at all, depending upon the tax compliance behavior of their employees. And that's sort of separate issue from the do we need to do this to enforce the independent contractor provision. Now, it's one thing that you could do would be to say, yes, we will in fact do what I guess is paragraph B of this, and we'll wait on paragraph A until the department works that out with standard employers. But the way I think about this is there are a couple of different issues that are going on at the same time, and that may be what's leading to some of this confusion.
I just had one additional question, and that's, Mr. Peterson, how would it work if I'm an employer, I properly classify my independent contractors that I'm using, am I penalized in this situation if they don't do what they're supposed to do, or am I rewarded for doing my job the way I'm supposed to do?
And Mr. Peterson. Sir, if they're truly independent contractors rather than employees, there's no consequence for the employer. If they're independent contractors in the construction trades and you're supposed to withhold and you didn't, then there would be a consequence to you. But otherwise, no. There's no consequence if you're using independent contractors and they're properly classified as independent contractors.
And then my final question, Madam Chair, is I'm looking at what you guys brought forward, and it says negligible in regards to the general fund impact, yet this provision clearly would appear to have a revenue increase attached to it. So I'm wondering how many other provisions in this bill are fiscal notes being requested that we could expect to maybe add up into a number that's different than negligible. Ms. Kadoon.
Madam Chair, I'm Representative Broad. As I mentioned, this provision, we are working on a fiscal note, so you can expect one for that. Other than that, there is a small fee in the use fee section that we're not talking about, and that we're working on a fiscal note for as well. So I apologize that the revenue estimate is not reflective of the fiscal notes, but those are two separate processes. Article 5 would be the use fee section, and that's not going to be heard today. They'll be introduced as a separate bill, and like I said, hopefully heard in the property tax division.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Please continue.
Section 7? Well, actually, Sections 7 and 11 are related. Section 11 repeals the Minnesota rule that's related to education deduction. The rule's been largely, if not completely, unamended, and just some technical word changes since the 1970s. Sadly outdated in many places, is obsolete, and most other places merely duplicative of the current statute. So we see the repeal as having no substantive effect, except for one provision in the rule, which prohibits the transportation deduction for use of the taxpayer's vehicle. So in Section 7, we're amending the statute to put into statute that the one provision that codifies the longstanding law of not allowing deductions for vehicles owned by the taxpayer or the student. Section 8. Last year, there were a number of changes to make uniform inflation adjustments throughout the revenue laws, and this, quite frankly, is one that was missed. It's one that kicks in for 2009, and it's a higher working family phase-out for married filing joint taxpayers. The change here will show that this additional threshold will be adjusted for 1 year of inflation, which was the state of the law before the changes that were made last year, rather than 8 or 9 years of inflation all in one. Sections 9 and 10 deal with concessions of judgment for manufactured homes and the property tax refund. The property tax refund law generally prohibits the property tax refund if there are delinquent taxes on the home. However, the law also says the taxes are not considered delinquent if the taxpayer signs a concession of judgment and is incurring on those obligations. The statute references the real property concession statute, and this change is just to clarify that it also applies to the personal property tax concession and judgment statutes. That's all it's on.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, that's it for Article 1, so if there's no questions on that article, we can move to Article 2, which is the sales and use taxes, and Greg Hatch would be presenting for that.
Okay, I don't have anybody on my list. Welcome to the committee.
Members of the chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Greg Hack. I'll be going through Article 2. It begins with the following of the bill. It's line 11.16.
Mr. Hack, excuse me to interrupt you for a moment. And let me indulge for a second. Was that your full name or was it shortened? Because that was my maiden name, but my father shortened it.
As far as I know, that's my full
name. Thank you. Representative Rick Arena.
Sir,
Representative Rick Arena, cousin. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hess. Please continue.
Sections 1 and 2 contain parallel provisions. Basically, since the sales tax came into existence in 1967, nonprofit organizations and exempt government units could not buy food or drinks except from sales tax. When we adopted the streamlined language, we removed the words foods and drinks from the statute and inserted the streamlined phrase prepared foods, candy, and soft drinks. This would theoretically allow nonprofits and government units to buy alcoholic beverages except from the sales tax. This was an oversight, and there was no revenue attached to this. We're basically correcting that oversight now and providing those organizations cannot buy alcoholic beverages except from the sales tax. Also in Section 2, there is an exemption for purchases by senior citizens groups, and we're clarifying that exemption does not apply to the purchase or construction of residential housing units. This would make this section parallel with the property tax treatment that's found now in Section 272.02, Subdivision 14. Sections 3 and 4 are parallel provisions in both the Metropolitan Transit Improvement Tax and the Greater Minnesota Transportation Tax. There's authority for those units imposing a $20 in lieu tax on motor vehicles. Basically, what we're providing here is what the definition of motor vehicles is. We're referring back to the definition now in Chapter 297B01. Section 5 of the repealer section. This is we're repealing the exemption for constitutional prohibitions. It's our position that if the tax is prohibited under the state or federal constitution, it's duplicative and unnecessary to put a statutory exemption in it because we are prohibited by the constitution. That is the end of Article 2, sales tax.
Thank you, Mr. Heckler. Representative Anderson, do you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. On sections 1 and 2, for section 1, does that apply to the state fair? And then does section 2 apply to, like, the Basilica Block Party and their purchase of alcohol? Do you know?
Madam Chair, Representative, it would apply to purchases for their own use. Obviously, they can buy alcoholic beverages for resale. This would basically say they cannot use it for their own purposes. That's correct. The only exception would be that religious organizations could purchase wine for sacramental purposes.
Okay. And then what about the state?
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What about for the state fair on section 1?
Mr. Heck.
Madam Chair, Representative, this would also apply to the state fair. They could not purchase it for state fair functions if the state fair board was to use it themselves. Obviously, they could purchase to be resold.
Okay.
But not for their own purposes.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none. Thank you, Mr. Heck. Ms. Kadoon.
Madam Chair, members, we'll now move to Article 3, which is special taxes, and then Pat Finnegan is here to present that article.
Welcome to the committee.
Morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Pat Finnegan from the Revenue Department. I'll take you through Article 3, which is the special taxes article. It begins on page 15 of the bill. These are all technical changes to a number of different tax types, and none of them have any direct revenue impact. Sections 1 and 2 are changes to the education funding chapter, 126C. What we're trying to do here is just move certain taconite production tax provisions from the production tax to this education funding chapter. So the sections 1 and 2 go along with section 17. We're deleting that same authority in the production tax area. Section 3 is a mortgage registry tax provision. It updates a cross-reference to the property tax classification statute for agricultural property. Section 4 is also a mortgage registry tax provision. It clarifies the tax when mortgages contain multiple statements that are each designed to limit the debt secured by the mortgage. In such cases, the tax on the mortgage is based on the actual combined effect of these statements and not if any, and not on the statements or portions of them taken in isolation. Section 5 is a D-tax provision. Last session, there were some changes in the authority to have death tax deeds. This exemption clause was added last year, and this just changes makes clear that the exemption also applies to related recorded documents, and generally we're just talking about required affidavits that have to be filed along with the deeds.
We have a question. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm back on Section 4, just reading it. Does, on a modification of a mortgage, it looks to me like the intent of this is if I modified, if the two people modify the mortgage and increase, let's say, from $200,000 to $250,000 or something, you get the extra tax. What if, as is happening now, we're having mortgage modifications downwards? Is this language going to possibly be interpreted that the state has to give back part of the mortgage tax?
Mr.
Fenn. It looks like pretty broad right now and might be interpreted that way.
Well, our intent here is just that if there's more than one statement on the document, we would read them all together to, you know, to read the intent into what was trying to occur there. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe this doesn't get to my question. What is the answer to my question? If that's not covered by here, because that's an obvious issue that suddenly popped up in the last roughly year.
But I'm going to ask Lance Stricker, who works in the property tax area, to maybe help us out.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, Lance Stricker, Department of Revenue. I also work in the mortgage and D-tax stuff.
two general rules would apply in the situation you're talking about. One rule is that the mortgage tax is determined at the time of recording, so things that happen later don't impact what the liability was. Second thing is there is a 3.5 year audit and correction period, but again, the situation you described, as I understood it, wouldn't be a correction. It would be a change that happened later on. So I go back to my first answer, which is the tax is at the time of recording, and things that happen later don't change.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
Representative Mulley.
One follow-up on that. So even you said at the time of recording, however, I could record, and sometimes the recording often is done of a modification, because if I don't record, then I don't have priority. So is it the original recording or the later recording?
Mr. Sirica.
Madam Chair, Representative Mulley, the smart aleck answer is both. When you record the first document, we determine the tax based on that document at that time. When you record the second document, if additional tax is due because of the second document, that would be due at that time. There would never be less tax due on the first document because of something you're recording later. The tax is determined at the time of recording.
Thank you. Please continue.
I think I was up to section 6 and 20 deal with deed tax stamps. And we're proposing to eliminate the procedure for paying the deed tax by purchasing stamps of given denominations from the county and affixing them on a deed. This is no longer done by the counties, so we're just eliminating the reference in our statutes to that procedure.
Excuse me, Representative Loeffler. Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't realize there were actually physical stamps and various denominations, and did each county have a unique version?
Madam Chair, Representative, at one time, they haven't used it for years, but I think at one time they had stamps that were, I think they were a statewide stamp. I mean, I could be wrong, but okay. It hasn't been used for a long time.
Thank you. Please continue.
Madam Chair, Section 7 begins from Minnesota Care Tax changes. That adds the surgical centers and wholesale drug distributors to the list of entities whose tax liability is transferred when accounts receivable are sold. Section 8 is also a Minnesota Care provision, and it adds surgical centers to the list of entities that may use an alternative method for calculating the cost of legend drugs when the entity cannot determine the actual cost of the drug. Section 9 and Section 12 are similar. Section 9 deals with the petroleum tax, and Section 12 deals with the lawful gambling tax. And they both deal with the statute of limitations. Clarifies that when a tax return is filed before the actual last day prescribed by law for filing, it's considered to be filed on the last day. That was proposed, I think, by we're dealing with a company on our integrated tax system, and they wanted that change just to clarify that it's treated the same as most of our other taxes. Sections 10, 13, 14, 16, and 19 deal with electronic payment requirements for lawful gambling tax at the distributor level, cigarette and tobacco products taxes, liquor taxes, insurance taxes, and a metropolitan solid waste landfill fee. And it's the proposal is to reduce the electronic payment threshold from $120,000 to $10,000 per fiscal year. So that'll bring these electronic payment requirements in line with most of our other major taxes. Section.
Excuse me, we have a question, Representative Cole.
Madam Chair, the moving that down to $10,000, first of all, as a general matter, I'm supportive of whatever we can do to, I think that creates efficiencies, but I guess I would have some concerns about some of our small C-stores and other small businesses across the state of Minnesota, and if we move down to $10,000 we're requiring electronic filing, do we have some level of comfort that they have the capacity to be able to do that today?
Madam Chair, Representative Cole.
This is not dealing with retail at the retail level. These are all basically wholesale taxpayers. So we're talking about liquor distributors, beer distributors, cigarette distributors, tobacco products, lawful gambling distributors, and then there's a solid waste landfill fee and insurance companies. So we're not really at the retail level. But I think there already is a $10,000 sales tax threshold at that level, if that's what you're asking.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Gardner.
I found this.
Thank you. Please continue.
Section 11 is a lawful gambling tax proposal, and it's just clarifying what signatures are required on an organization's gambling tax return. That in previous times, that requirement was set forth in a rule that the Gambling Control Board had, and when they were updating their rules a year or two ago, that section was deleted. So we're just putting that same language back into our statute. I already did Section 12. Section 15 is an insurance tax proposal. It's adding a new subdivision to provide that when good cause exists, the commissioner may extend the time for filing returns for not more than 6 months. Apparently in the insurance premiums tax area, in that statute, we didn't have a specific authority to grant extensions to file the returns. Section 17 I've already discussed. Section 18 is a production tax technical change, and it's just deleting obsolete language that was only effective for 2003 distributions. And then Section 20 is a repealer, and it's repealing some obsolete provisions in the mineral tax statutes.
Questions, members? Thank you. Ms. Kadun?
Madam Chair, we'll move to Article 4, which is the property taxes and aids, and Lance Tarita will walk through that provision.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Members. The way I counted this, Article 4 has 24 sections, and 17 of them are related in one way or another to last year's legislation, about three-quarters of them. The first one is such a provision. It has to do with indexing the agricultural homestead first tier limit. Normally in the fall of this year, 09, the Department of Revenue would do a calculation based on some average values from the 08 assessment, the 09 assessment. Those categories were changed last year, so we can't compare the same categories from 08 to 09. To create this value for the 2010 assessment, so this statute would be amended. We'd reset the value using trends for 2010 and then continue the computations using the new categories after that. Section 2, similarly, has to do with...
Excuse me, Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much.
Question?
I do have a question. Thank you, Madam Chair. The question is, now that was up to 890,000, I think, for, was it 08 or 09, but does that impact? I know it's supposed to go up over $1 million for the first tier, which I think sometimes is lost, and we hear all this green acres debate and everything, and there's been a lot of benefits that we've tried to help out farmland taxes, but will this affect it moving up to over $1 million on the first tier? I think that's what it was forecast to go for, either 09 or 10, one of the two years, I guess.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Jason Nord. I work in the property tax division of the Department of Revenue. And Representative Marquardt, yes, we actually did in December the indexing for assessment year 2009. So for assessment year 2009, the tier break is $1,010,000. So it had gone from, it used to be $600,000. It first indexed up to $690,000, then $790,000, then $890,000. We kind of skipped over 990 this year and went $1,010,000. So yeah. So and we will try, and we're kind of waiting for some spring mini data as far as plugging the number right now. We just have dot 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 there. So we may end up pegging it at around, you know, 1,140,000, something like that. But we'll wait till we get a little bit better data to try and plug that number.
But thank you. For 09, then it stays at the 1,010,000.
Correct.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. Mr. Tarica?
Section 2, again, similarly, has to do with an index calculation for the green acre changes that were made last year. This index applies to the value of the non-productive lands that were grandfathered in, and it just lags that computation by 1 year to avoid using data from the current year to develop a value for the current year. Section 3 has to do with something that was in last year's bill, the Aggregate Resources Preservation Act. This is the statute 273-1115 that gets a market value exclusion. Right now, the classes that are eligible for that are residential and farm, excluding the classification if you have the same kind. There's two provisions were enacted last year, market value exclusion in 273-1115, excuse me, and a class rate provision in the agricultural classification statute. Right now, it looks like if you're a residential property and you apply for the class rate provision first, you won't then be qualify for the market value exclusion because that 2E isn't listed as one of the ones that are qualified. And we think the intent was to allow that kind of property to qualify for both regardless of which one they applied for first. Section 4 and 5 have to do with the bovine property tax credit that was enacted last year. The summary is kind of backwards. The first thing it does is include farms from which herds were eradicated in 2006. Last year we thought that happened in 2007. We want to make sure everybody's covered. The second thing that happens is from parcels to property, that's to make sure that the entire farm qualifies regardless of whether it has one, two, three, or several parcels. Six is again related something in last year's bill. We thought we had this in last year's bill, but it only got the Senate version and then it got dropped. It has to do with the abatements and credits that we recodified in the special session of 2007 for the Ham Lake fire and the floods down in southeast. We recodified those property tax abatements and credits. And what we set up was a system where the counties can give abatements and credits, and but then the commissioner would give abatements and credits for property that the commissioner assesses. And this just clarifies the definition of what that utility property is that the commissioner assesses.
Excuse me, Mr. Speaker, we have a question. Representative Schulberg.
Can I just go back to sections 4 and 5 of section? And that is, if I'm a farmer and I have a herd of cattle on this part of my land, and then I own land 10 miles away that isn't related at all to any kind of cattle on it or anything else, and another land another 10 miles away, and another one over here someplace that none of them are connected with at all with my cattle, and I destroy my cattle, that I get a big tax break on the other street as well, even though they're not...
Mr. Nord.
Madam Chair, Representative Colbert. It's a good question, and it's something that we've struggled with the existing language. The existing language originally talked about only a partial qualifying, but it was apparent from that the legislative intent was not just for sub parcels within a farm to qualify, that the intent was that a farm as a unit would qualify, and the revenue analysis was done based on farms as a unit qualifying. But when you do have farms that are scattered, as you say, across different areas, the language that we were relying on to provide instructions for Texas Table 2009, there's a definition of located within the zone. And that definition of located within the zone talks about the cattle being kept in the area. And so we're working with some real tentative language with the current law. We're relying on that in the area language to ask the counties to use a little bit of discretion when they're allocating how many acres to be eligible for the credit. So if you had the credit on, say, I think we're going with basically like a rough 320-acre rule of thumb. So if all of your farmland and all of your holdings adds up to less than 320 acres, we're not getting too picky about whether or not the somewhat distant parcels are in the area or not. But when you get to a really large farm, so if you had like a 2,000-acre farm, but you only had 20 head of cattle, instead of giving that credit to all 2,000 acres, we're trying to cut it off at a reasonable level, using this really loose language about in the area. And so this proposal is to clarify that parcel really means property, that it doesn't just mean specific parcel, because otherwise you can have a lot of cattle, and if it's all kept on a very small parcel, you're only getting a very small credit, even though you may be using the rest of your farm to support those cattle. So the language we're working with is really kind of loose. This provision probably isn't the end of the story, and my understanding is that Representative Olin and Senator Skoy may have ideas about making some changes on a go-forward basis to the bovine credit, but the existing language we're working with, we're kind of dancing on that issue.
Sir, I think we need some strong clarification so that you don't open this wide open to... I know we have a big problem in northwestern Minnesota, but just because there's a problem, that doesn't mean that every piece of parcel of land should have a big tax break as well. So I think it needs to be defined very tightly. And it seems to me that your proposal here is loosening it more than tightening it.
Mr. Nord?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, I would agree that it would be very desirable to have some much more concrete language to work with. I think we are loosening it a little bit in the fact that we're loosening it beyond a single, the parcel itself to a broader property. But we've heard a lot of indications that was legislative intent, and so we are, yes, loosening it, but we're also administratively trying to control it as well, and so it would definitely be good to get some language enhancements here.
Ma'am, Chair, I would think that at least it should be contiguous to where the herd is being eradicated, from which the herd is being eradicated.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, that would definitely be welcome to the Department of Revenue. I think there may be, of course, you'll run into then the farmer who's got an 80-acre parcel where the cows are, and a quarter mile down the road he has an 80-acre parcel where he grows all the hay, or maybe he moves the cattle over there too. So there's always a unique situation that causes you to really wrangle with the language. But certainly like to see some better language on the bovine credit. And so this is just our starting point, but perhaps it's not the ending point.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Strica, would you like to continue?
I believe we were on Section 7. Section 7 makes a change. Something we should have done a long time ago. On the homestead applications, if the property is occupied by an by a relative of the owner, this just clarifies that the spouse of that relative must also provide their Social Security number and sign the application. Section 8.
Oh, Representative Rukavina.
As simple as this is, relative homestead has been around for 15, 12, 15 years. And so, is there a huge problem out there? Is this something that's supposed to be taxed on our revenue and determine that it's going to pass?
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina. A little bit of both. to my knowledge, it's a little bit of both. We have limited resources to do more things that we could probably do with those resources. So, the time and energy that we spend
auditing, if you will, homestead applications for duplicates does vary over the years. Some years it goes a while before we focus on that. The other side to the, so this may have something to do with that ebb and flow that we're getting back into that for some reason. The second part of it is for a while, more than a couple weeks, we've been aware of the fact that there was this gap in the law about who's required to provide their social security numbers and signatures on the applications. Again, that's not been our highest priority to attack that gap, and we're doing it this year.
Representative Rukavina.
When I read it, I mean, you know, it's not much, but for years and years it said that, you know, they file an affidavit or homestead application with the assessor, and then the social security number of the relative and the spouse that has to be on the application. So, you know, it requires both the spouse and the relative of the person at the homestead. I don't know why you got it. You know, spend time on this stuff because they're already filing their social security number, the spouse is filing their social security number. So.
Mr. Stern,
I hate giving government a little more authority.
Madam Chair, Representative Rufina, going from memory, I would just bet that you're looking at paragraph C. Excuse me? Well, then it wasn't in the other one. With all due respect.
I'm just curious, actually. It's been there for 50 years. I don't know, you know.
I think there is a gap there. If someone has continuing questions, we'd be glad to look into that further. Section 8. Section 8 has to do with homesteads for property held in trust. A couple of years ago, we did this in order to clarify the law. It used to be kind of a complicated determination. We had to look at the trust and see if the person had a legal right to occupy the property. Now we've traded that off for a statute that says if you have these three things, you get a homestead. The statute, however, starts out by saying real property, and we've found situations where people have homesteads on personal property, such as a manufactured home. So we're changing that to include both types of trust-held homesteads. The rest of the changes in that section are just to clarify wording. Section 9 has to do with the managed forest land class that we changed a little bit last year, and just to add the provision to that class that we have in the rural vacant land class about the presence of a minor structure, ancillary structure, won't destroy the primary classification of the property, and to add a May 1st deadline to the application for the people who have the managed forest land. Section 10, again, the summary is backwards. The first thing happening in Section 10 is some technical clarifications having to do with resorts where they have to provide records of rentals and records of receipts on certain activities. Right now it says Class 4C, but those things really only apply to the Category 4C1. Those are just technical changes. The second thing that's happening is to amend the community service organization provision that we had last year where they're exempt if they donate amounts equal to their property taxes. We're expanding that by including the 501c8 organizations, which we think were inadvertently left out last year, and those are certain fraternal benefit societies. I mentioned Knights of Columbus, but that's kind of a vague reference because the Knights of Columbus has different wings and auxiliaries and so forth, but it's basically 501c8, which is some sort of fraternal benefit society. Section 11 has to do with last year's bill. This is a provision that tells, as far as classifying vacant land, used to be vacant land had its own category. Now we tell the assessors to classify vacant land according to its highest and best use, might be commercial, might be residential, whatnot. We're putting an exception into that for the rural vacant land because that already has a definite classification, rural vacant land. Section 12, 13, and 17 have to do with utility values determined by the commissioner and when those values are provided to the counties, changing it from basically July 1st to August 1st to give us more time to deal with these complex reports and computations. Sections 14, 15, and 16 have to do with county boards of appeal and equalization. 14 and 15 kind of go together and basically provide that if the county board or the special board, the county board appoints to hear appeals is not able to meet because they didn't satisfy their training or quorum requirements, that that person who could have appealed there administratively can come to the commissioner. And then we impose a fee. This is, wanted to mention here is another fee of $500, but we don't expect any revenue from this fee. The fee would be $500 per tax parcel, which is fairly high, for each of those appeals that come to the commissioner. Our thought here is that this won't happen. I don't believe there's fiscal impact estimated for this because our idea is that this... This shouldn't happen in the first place, but the imposition of the fee would go a long ways to strengthen the possibility that it wouldn't occur.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The in Section 14, the I don't have any problem with the quorum requirement, but I guess my question relates to the training requirement. Can you just briefly explain what that training requirement is, and is that a funded or an unfunded mandate for our counties?
Madam Chair, Representative Colt, it is unfunded. It's basically, I think it's a day-long class with a handbook. That's about the extent of my knowledge. I'm not sure if anyone else here. Okay.
Jason Nord can answer this.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Musical chair. Mr. Nord.
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, this was we had recently adopted the training requirement a couple of years ago for local boards, and the consequence of the local boards failing to obtain the training or have the, or meet the quorum requirement was that their powers of review would default to the county. So then last year we added the counties to gave the counties the same training requirement to where they also needed to be educated in the ways of running a good Board of Appeals, and then if they do not comply with those requirements, currently there's no real consequence. They would have to appoint a special board, and then if the special board isn't trained, there's no real consequence for the requirement. And so our attempt this year is to add that consequence that because the taxpayers then are left with nowhere to appeal. And so we're in this year's language, we're saying, okay, the taxpayer could then appeal directly to the Department of Revenue, but certainly we don't want to be flooded with appeals directly from taxpayers from a whole county. So that's why we're implementing the $500 fee per appeal as the consequence. And so essentially we're just piggybacking on last year's changes, providing a stronger consequence to make sure that boards of appeal and equalization are run correctly.
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to, I guess, summarize, last year we put an unfunded mandate in place. We didn't have an enforcement mechanism. Now we have an unfunded mandate with an enforcement mechanism. I guess I'll look forward to chatting with my friends from the counties as to whether this one makes sense or not. I don't have any problem with the quorum requirement. That makes complete sense to me, but... and I want to make sure that our county boards treat taxpayers properly when they come before them on an appeal. But you know, our counties are having all kinds of financial problems as well, and so I don't know what kind of impact this has on them. But you know, anything we can do to reduce some of those administrative burdens is something I'm interested in taking a look at. Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Madam Chair. Sections 18 and 19 and 25, again, relate to last year's bill and the levy limitations. Section 18, change of three special levies, one for vote-approved debt to make a technical change, one for lake improvement districts to make a technical change, to eliminate language that is somewhere, that continues to exist somewhere else, and then strike the special levy for county court costs where the court was not yet taken over by the state, that's obsolete. Section 19 makes a correction to a cross-reference in the levy limit, determination of the levy limit statutes. Then Section 25 repeals some rules that had to do with the previous a previous incarnation of levy limits, and those levy limits were repealed in 1997. The fear is that someone would use something in the rule from the levy limits related to 1997 to force an interpretation that we weren't comfortable with for the new levy limits. If the logic of that argument is correct, we would adopt it, but we don't want to get caught on a technicality.
Excuse me, Mr. Streeka, Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair, what is the definition of court administrative costs?
Mr.
Madam Chair, if I may ask a question. One of the costs that was at the state level at one time was public defenses for children being taken away from their families on both sides, even though that's not a constitutional one. The mandated service, it was a state-provided service, and the state is no longer providing that services, and courts are now ordering the county to provide the service. Is that the court administrative cost?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, that outside my area, for the purposes of levy limits, and I'm sure this is not the question you asked, but for the purposes of levy limits, whether that particular amount was in the court administration costs,
I'm going to interrupt. Ms. Dalton would like to comment on this.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, that section 14 that is being, or that clause 14 that is being stricken, actually was limited to very specific court-administered costs that the state was taking over, and there was a six-month delay so that we had to kind of fix the difference between the county and the city fiscal years. Just wouldn't apply to what you're talking about.
Okay, thank you.
Madam
Thank
Chair,
you. Continue.
I believe you were on Section 20. Section 20 has to do with the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act. It again requires us, again, it's related to last year's bill. This provision in the statute requires us to make some computations based on average values from properties in certain classifications. Those classes have been changed. So we've had to update the cross-reference to those classifications, trying to get as close as we could to the prior classifications that were in this statute. Section 21, similarly with the Forest Incentive Act, required us to compute some statewide average tax amount based on averages of this and that. The this and that categories have changed, and so in this case, for Section 21, we're replacing a reference to a class rate for 2B property with a reference to 1%, which was the class rate for the 2B property, just a way of accommodating the changes that happened to the agricultural classification. Section 22, 23, and 24 have to do with local government aid. 22 makes a, and all of these are related to last year's bill. Section 22 makes the change to the definition of city revenue need, moving the minimum amount from the end to towards the beginning. Section 23 is a cross-reference to a different paragraph that changed in, while we were crossing the stream, because one of those paragraphs was eliminated at the time. The correct reference was correct. By the time the bill was passed, it needed to be changed. Section 24, I think it's going to be amended. It has to do with provision enacted last year to reduce the volatility of the aid, local government aid payments. And what we tried to do in this bill is to make some exception to what data was being frozen. And as I understand it, not to get ahead of myself here, but as I understand it, what the exceptions that we put in to the frozen values need to be restated slightly. If anybody wants more detail on that.
Members? No.
Madam Chair, that's Article 4.
Thank you. Madam Chair, our last article is the miscellaneous article, and Joan Tewitt will present that.
Madam Chair?
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
The first change in Section 1 makes changes to the set-off provisions in Chapter 16D. Generally, these provisions allow the amount of a debt owed to the state to be automatically deducted from any payments that the state owes the debtor for the debtor providing goods and services to the state. Before the set-off may be done, written notice of the intent to set-off must be sent to the debtor by certified mail. This proposal would remove the requirement that the notice be sent by certified mail and allow the notice to be sent by regular first-class mail. Section 2 is a proposal to amend the tax disclosure chapter.
Never mind. Please continue.
To amend the tax disclosure chapter to make it clear that harassment is an additional circumstance under which tax return information may be disclosed to law enforcement authorities. Current law specifically allows disclosure of return information to apprise law enforcement of the threat of death or physical injury to a department employee or other person. This proposal would make it clear that the commissioner is also not prohibited from informing law enforcement when a taxpayer is criminally harassing a department employee, and notifying law enforcement is necessary for protection.
Excuse me. Representative Histon, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment. The Senate did take this subdivision out because they felt that the Judiciary Committee should probably hear it in the Senate, and so that might be something you might want to think about here in the House as well.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay, Sections 3 and 4 clarify that the publication of tax preparers subject to penalty requirements. Under Minnesota statutes, the Commissioner is required to publish a list of tax preparers who have either been convicted under the criminal provisions of 289A63 or have been assessed penalties in excess of $1,000 under Section 289A60, sub 13A. This proposal would clarify 2 points. First, that preparers subject to publication due to a criminal penalty must have been a preparer with respect to the return or claim from which the criminal penalty arose. And second, that the preparer bears the burden of demonstrating to the commissioner that conditions for removal from the list have been met, including satisfaction of any criminal sentence that has been imposed. Section 5, we clarify that all applicable penalties and interest may be assessed for personal liability in the same manner as the underlying tax, and it makes it clear that the personal liability assessment of penalties and interest is treated consistently for all taxes that are subject to personal liability assessment. This language would parallel the treatment of penalties and interest and personal liability assessments prior to various decodifications that have occurred over the last several years. And finally, Section 6 is a technical proposal to the provision that suspends the time for assessment or collection of a tax during bankruptcy. The running of the time for assessment or collection is suspended from the date of filing a bankruptcy petition until 30 days after the notice to the commissioner that the bankruptcy has been closed or dismissed or that the automatic stay has been lifted. This proposal just clarifies that the notice requirement applies to both the fact that the proceeding has been closed or dismissed and that the automatic stay has been terminated or expired. And there's also an amendment to Article 6 that I can discuss at this time if you'd like me to, Madam Chair.
If I can ask you to hold off just one moment, okay. Please. Representative Liebling had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. I wanted to go back for a second to Section 1, which eliminates the certified mail requirement. Could you discuss that a little bit more? I mean, are we saving lots and lots of money by doing that? This seems to me that that's kind of a... It makes sense to give somebody the courtesy of certified mail to make sure they're notified before we start taking their money.
Madam Chair, Representative, first of all, this would only apply to payments that the state owes the debtor for contracts for goods and services. So this would be a situation where we have money that we're paying them and they also owe us money for a fine or something similar. The debtor has been contacted a number of times prior to this, before this notice is set out. And also there's been department experience that regular mail often provides better notice than certified mail, because if the debtor doesn't pick it up, they receive no notice at all. And as far as the cost provision, there's the additional cost of certified mail. There's also the certified mail process is quite labor intensive, so there's the cost of department employees, taking those steps to send it certified. There's a process that certified mail can't be automated, so it has to be somehow taken out of the regular system and done separately, so a process has to be developed for that. So it is a little more costly than just the actual cost of certified mail.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And well, just to follow up, I mean, give us an idea how costly it is. I mean, presumably you're already doing it this way, so there's procedure in place, right? And I guess I get the point about sometimes you don't get certified mail if you don't go and pick it up, but you're saying that by the time you get to the certified mail, they've already gotten some notice by regular mail, right? And you just want to eliminate the extra step of the certified?
Madam Chair, Representative, we would still send notice, but it would just be by regular mail, not certified. Plus, if before that notice, they would have also received notice from the state agency to whom they owe the debt, and also another notice from us saying you owe this amount. Please contact us, either pay it or contact us to make arrangements to pay. If they do contact us to make arrangements to pay, then this collection tool would not be used. It cannot be used if the debtor has made payment arrangements.
Well,
thank you, Representative Liebling.
Madam Chair, it sounds like you're probably only sending the certified mail in a very small number of cases then, because it's then only when you haven't already gotten a response through these other channels that you're getting to the certified mail. And it just seems to, well, first of all, you didn't really answer the piece about how much money we might be saving by cutting this out, but also it seems to me that besides giving some assurance that the mail actually is going to a place where the person actually lives or would get their mail, that you're also, the department would kind of be covering itself by, there's some proof there that you actually did send the notice. So, please answer a question, if you can, about how much we're saving.
Madam Chair, Representative. The cost, I think, their department estimates there'd be about 3,500 certified letters that you would, if you did the total population for these offsets. So the cost savings for not having to do that would be, I think it'd be under probably $12,000-$13,000. But just to emphasize again, the population we're talking about would be individuals who owe non-tax debts to other agencies. So somebody who maybe had a fine at another agency. They're now doing work for the state, so maybe doing some construction for the state, and we would then be paying them. Another agency would be paying them. We would then be, what this does is it offsets those vendor payments. So if they owe a fine to another agency and are receiving a payment from another agency, we're going to offset that fine. So that's a way to collect the fine that's owed to another agency. So the population is fairly limited. But so these are individuals, like I said, that were getting money from the state but also owe the state money. So it's a much more efficient way is if it doesn't have to be done by certified mail. And the experience of the department is that most people do not pick up their certified mail. So if you're really trying to provide notice, they're more apt to get just the notice from regular mail.
So Madam Chair, if I could just for one more second. I think I'm understanding this, but so is part of the point here that since they're at the same time getting payments, that gives us some assurance that we know where they are? Is that part, because otherwise I'm still kind of thinking it's not necessarily a fair thing to do, but if we have some assurance because we have a current relationship with them.
Ms. Cadoon.
Madam Chair, I think that's exactly right. You should have a better idea if they're receiving payment. We should have a better idea where they're at. But however, if we've sent a regular mail and we receive it back because that's not the correct address, the department does do due diligence on finding the correct address to provide notification to this person. They contract with private vendors to find them, to do some internal work.
they go through credit bureaus to find the right address for these people.
Thank you. And members, I apologize. We did run over today. I'm sorry if there's somebody from the audience who wishes to testify. We will be taking this up at a future date. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.